property investment with a twist and the keys to finding equity in your investment. PropertyWise.
Welcome back to PropertyWise, and great to be back with you, and great to be with you, Bob.
Great to be back again, Ben.
Absolutely. Today we're talking about purchase contracts. Critical topic, obviously, if you're looking to buy an investment property.
Well, they're a legally binding instrument, so you've got to get it right.
Absolutely. Let's go straight over to the headline news, and then we'll get into it.
In this part of the news, we take a look at what's expected for interest rates over the next 12 months and which kinds of properties are most popular with home buyers. Coming up later, we investigate the ups and downs of rental prices, as well as the licensing and status of real estate agents. Although the Reserve Bank is expected to continue the current period of stability by leaving rates on hold at its March 4th meeting, some believe we could see a hike by early 2015. Westpac Bank said that there was virtually no chance of an increase next month and was doubtful there would be any movement until the second half of 2014. This is despite dwelling approvals being down, unemployment prospects up, and a surprise inflation lift in December. AMP Capital and RP Data have both said similar things as well, that there won't be any increase in the interest rate until late in 2014. Investors hoping to preempt any movement should watch for forecasts for 2015 as the key indicators for any move by the Reserve Bank. A recent study has found that demand for units, townhouses and semi-detached homes across Australia continued to rise over the past 12 months, reaching the highest level on record. The Bankwest Housing Density Report revealed over 43% of total new home approvals were for medium density dwellings, a rise of 3.6% on the previous year. Bankwest said there's an ongoing trend towards medium density property at the expense of standalone homes. Their analysis revealed medium density approvals increased by almost 23% on the previous year, which is considerably higher than the 6.5% increase in standalone home approvals. Their analysis revealed medium density approvals increased by almost 23% on the previous year, which is considerably higher than the 6.3% increase in standalone home approvals. The study said the increasing popularity of medium density housing was possibly being driven by first-time homebuyers finding it difficult to afford a standalone house. SQM Research's latest Asking Rents Index shows the asking prices for rental properties have been mixed compared to this time last year. The capital city average showed a 0.7% decrease in asking rents for houses, while the asking price for units was up 1.7%. Asking prices for rent are directly linked to vacancy rates, which indicate the level of untenanted residential property in each city. Sydney outpaced all other capital cities over the year with a 2.1% increase in rents for houses and a 3.9% increase for units. And Canberra recorded the steepest declines with a 10.3% drop in rents for houses and a 6.5% decrease for units. When there is a strong sales market, as in the case in Sydney and Melbourne right now, rental demand can weaken. SQM noted that as prospective buyers leave the rental market to purchase their own properties, this typically leads to an elevation in vacancies. SQM said those considering investing in the CBDs of Brisbane, Perth and Melbourne should be strongly aware that vacancy rates are rising rapidly in these locations.
Okay, we're talking about purchase contracts. We're focusing on as if you were the buyer, and we're talking about established investment properties. So talking about either a house or a unit, something that's pre-existing and you're looking to purchase it. Big topic, obviously very critical when you're going to purchase that the contract's correct, and varies quite a bit from state to state, doesn't it?
Yeah, they do in different states, the way the whole thing rolls out. In New South Wales, you've got exchanges and all sorts of things can happen, like getting gazumped. Mm. But Victoria, yeah, it's a bit different again. The contracts themselves fall under contract law, so federally there's a whole law that governs contracts.
Right.
But that said, the paperwork can vary a bit from state to state.
Absolutely. So let's talk a bit generally about the purpose of the contract. What's it there for in the transaction?
Well, yeah, I guess it's a legal agreement, isn't it? It's an agreement between, a buyer and a seller, and it sets out what they've agreed to do, what the property is, the price, all those things.
Right, yeah, so it's the key document that, documents the agreement on the transfer of this property.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, in most states, you can use a standard contract, can't you? So you've got your, in Queensland, it's the AIQ contract, and it's got all the standard conditions, and they're the most common form of contract.
Yeah, it is, yeah, and put together initially by the Law Society. So, yeah, they're just off-the-shelf contracts, the sort of contract we're talking residential property here too.
Sure.
The sort of contract that in most cases the agent puts together.
Right, yep.
Or fills in the missing pieces, and as it turns out.
Sure, that's right. And then what about that? You don't have to use that one, do you?
Well, you don't. You can actually have a lawyer draw up your own contract. It's not very common. I've seen it more on commercial properties. Also properties that go to auction sometimes.
Right.
Where a lawyer actually draws up the contract. It's not an off-the-shelf one.
It's just a customised version.
Hmm. Yeah. Same way you can have building contracts off-the-shelf or customised, any form of contract.
Right. So if you're looking at one of those contracts, you obviously want to go through it pretty closely and make sure it's all the...
Well, yeah, I'd get my lawyer to go through it, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, just the way some words are written, the way inferences, clauses, yeah, somebody smarter than me, a good lawyer.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned auctions, Bob. Often at auctions, it's actually an unconditional contract, isn't it?
Well, that's right, yeah. And, of course, our friends in Victoria know all about auctions. Most of the sales there are done by auction.
Mm.
Less so New South Wales. Queensland generally don't really like auctions all that much. Knock off one of the agents, one of the big agents that pushes them, there wouldn't be any at all. But, yeah, you're right. Look, at the fall of the hammer, if it reaches a reserve, it's usually a 30-day unconditional cash contract with a 10% deposit.
So as a buyer, you want to make sure you've got the, if you're going to bid at auction, that you're pretty sure that you're going to get the money or you've already got the money.
Well, you want to be sure you get the money, okay, and because you can get pre-approval, so you can bid up to a certain level.
Right.
Don't get carried away with emotion, though. And, of course, if it gets passed in, then it's game on. Then we can start looking at conditions and so forth. But, yeah, look, lock yourself in. You've got to do your due diligence early.
Sure.
Most auctions, you might have a 5 or 6 week lead time. So it gives you a bit of time to get some due diligence done because, mate, if you're there and the hammer falls and it's in your name.
It's yours.
Better have a checkbook on you and money in the bank.
Now, let's talk about what the contract contains generally as far as the different things that it sets out between the two parties, I guess. So, and I guess that is the first thing, isn't it? Sets out the parties and their details, who they are legally, the names, addresses, contact details, those kinds of things.
Yeah, exactly. Buyer's name, seller's name, lawyers and that sort of thing. You know, just talking about buyer's name, it's very important, particularly with an investment property, to have the right entity set up in advance.
Right.
Which means going to a really clever property lawyer because you might be using one of your structures. Could be a discretionary trust, could be whatever you're using, corporate trustee. Make sure you get that set up first. Don't just go and stick it in your own name and find, oh, gee, now the accountant said I should have put it in this. Bad luck.
And try to swap it because there's all kind of implications, isn't there?
Well, yeah, immediately stamp duty.
Which can be very expensive.
Yeah, so obviously get that first, but that's a little tip.
Talk to your accountant, talk to your solicitor, get it all locked in place.
Yep. Get your finance sorted out first, particularly with an auction, and get your entity right.
Now, next part of the contract is obviously the property itself. So normally we're going to have the real property description and some other details on what you're actually buying. And again, you want to make sure that's accurate as well.
Yeah, that's right. And even things like chattels, you know, there's often a bit of a punch-up sometimes between buyers and sellers about what's fixtures and what's not. You know, you think those big pot plants that are about, you know, weigh about 2 ton were fixtures and you find that when you move in, they're all gone.
Mm.
Or maybe a barbecue that was built in brick and then the plate and the gas bottle's gone.
Right.
You know, all sorts of things. So it's important, even things like the chattels, to get them right.
Or plants from the garden, potentially.
Well, yeah, now. Were they in pots or were they in the ground? In the ground, yeah. All that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Now, price. That's obviously a big consideration on your contract and that's obviously going to be set out there along with the deposit that's payable.
That's right too. And, you know, it could be a part deposit. You might be paying a deposit in one or two parts.
Sure.
But that needs to be set out.
Absolutely. And that's often not a bad idea, isn't it? If you're wanting to, say, do some due diligence on the property or whatnot, pay a small deposit up front, get your due diligence done, pay the rest on the balance?
Yeah, look, sometimes, particularly, I mean, a bit different when we buy development sites as well, we often split the deposits. As certain conditions are met, we pay a bit more. I can't see the point in having a whacking big deposit in there if it's still conditional upon a whole heap of things happening.
Absolutely. Now, conditions, that's obviously probably the final main element of what the contract contains. In your standard contracts, you've got pages of standard conditions.
Oh, yeah.
And then obviously you may have some of your own special conditions that you might add in. And we've actually got Robert from Slater and Gordon coming on a little bit later to talk to us specifically about conditions. But you always got conditions in there.
You have, you know, and when you're talking about just not so much the standard conditions that are in there, but, you know, special conditions, is there's two parts, there's two critical parts to me in a contract, the price and the conditions.
Right.
And sometimes you might be better off not arguing too much about the price if you can get the conditions that you want.
Right.
And there's all sorts of conditions and, you know, prior entry, the length of the contract, you might be able to get a longer contract that might suit you for certain circumstances. So it can be a bit of a playoff. Price isn't always the most critical thing. Sometimes, you know, the conditions actually, if you get the right conditions, can be more important even than the price.
Absolutely. And on that note, let's cut over to Robert from Slater and Gordon. He's going to talk to us all about conditions. Okay, well, thanks very much for joining us, Robert, on Property Wise. We're talking about purchase contracts in the show today, and we've got you on to talk about contract conditions and for the purchase of established investment properties, could be a house or a unit. So could you run us over to start with just the basic kind of conditions that you find in most contracts of your building and pest and your finance and kind of what the purpose of those are in the contract and what they do for the buyer?
Thanks for having me, Ben. Absolutely. I would generally, in a established property contract, you would see a couple of conditions. One would be the finance clause and the second would be the building and pest clause.
Sure.
The finance clause would be for the purpose of if the potential buyer is looking to borrow funds to buy into the property or buy the property,
yep.
They may not have absolutely secured 100% unconditional financing from their bank as of the date of the contract.
Right.
The bank may have further conditions outstanding as to a valuation of the property or seeing the contract fully signed prior to giving the unconditional finance approval. And therefore, then, the buyer may wish to have the contract subject to a finance period or subject to a finance date, so say 14 days or 21 days after the signing of the contract.
Right.
By which they can, within that time, they can then go to their bank and get, hopefully, unconditional finance approval to purchase the place.
Sure. And then obviously if they can't secure that, then they've got the right to terminate. Is that right?
That's correct. And generally you would get your full deposit back out of that, barring any special conditions that's been inserted for a minimum to be returned to the seller or to be kept by the seller, or unrefundable deposit basically.
Okay. Good. Now what about the building and pest side of things?
I would also, generally you would also see a building and pest clause in the contract as well. This is especially if it's an older property or if it's a standalone established property, so it's not, say, a unit in a building or an established building.
Right.
That sort of a clause would give the buyer a period in which they can conduct or get an expert to conduct building and pest inspection of the property to ensure that the building is sound and stable and to make sure that there are no potential issues with the building, i.e., termites infested or their structural issues with the foundations of the building or how the building has matured over the years.
Sure.
And if any of those issues did arise, it again potentially gives the buyer to an ability to terminate the contract, or alternatively they could try and negotiate with the seller and say, look, this issue has arisen in my report. Are we able to potentially negotiate a price reduction, or maybe the seller may agree to prepare some more, undertake some works prior to settlement.
Right, yeah, you see quite a bit of that, don't you? Like you get the building and pest report, it'll have a whole list of items. You go off and get a quote to basically rectify all those items, and then there's a bit of a negotiation going on with between the parties.
That's correct. Sometimes you'll see some sellers say, look, absolutely no, take it or leave it.
Yep.
But a lot of the times the sellers are willing to undertake this sort of work. They want to get the settlement, they want to get the property sold, and they're willing to at least maybe negotiate on some price or some reduction in the price, or at least carry out some work prior to settlement, because they don't want to see it have to try and sell it again, or you know, get the agent involved to try and sell it to someone else.
Too much hassle. And by that stage, they're usually reasonably committed because you've had 14 days or 21 days and so time's moved on. So it's not a bad clause to have. Well, like you say, it's pretty much a standing clause for most contracts when you're purchasing.
Absolutely. I'd definitely recommend it in there as well.
Excellent. Now, let's talk about, so that's kind of your standard conditions, and then we've obviously got special conditions. So can you tell us about some of the more common special conditions and what their purpose would be in the contract for a buyer?
Absolutely. Well, the first one I would generally recommend would be a due diligence clause. Now, the purpose of that would be so that you can, or a buyer can inspect or make investigations into the property that they may wish to undertake, or that may determine their ability to purchase the property or their need, want to purchase the property.
Right.
In that regard, I would always recommend to clients that you carry out all investigations and searches into the property prior to signing the contract.
Sure.
However, sometimes I can definitely understand, say, a seller says, look, I've got three other buyers on the line. A buyer wants to secure the property as soon as possible. Maybe they want to get their finance application underway as soon as possible and get the settlement. So they say, look, I'm happy to buy the place, but I want to carry out these investigations first and make sure that, therefore, if any investigations came up adverse, i.e., say, a building approval on the property hasn't been granted, or there's issues with, say, a flood search that the buyer undertakes, you'd potentially want the ability to terminate, which you potentially could do under a due diligence clause.
Right, so that's a bit of a catch-all, isn't it, potentially to due diligence clause if you've got a broad one where you're just saying, oh, I can basically do any kind of searches or investigations I like, and if I'm not happy with them, I can terminate.
It very much is a catch-all, and I can appreciate sometimes where sellers get a bit scared of having that big catch-all because it means the buyer can go out, do 1,000 searches, and if one little thing comes back which says it's a bit iffy, then the seller or the buyer may wish to terminate and the seller gets a bit frightened. Therefore, then, the alternative would be that if the buyer's got any particular issues or particular concerns, i.e. they see the building's a bit worn or see that there's, say, an extension been added to the building, and they say, look, I've got a concern whether or not that's been granted building approval, I don't want the council coming around later to sue me or to tell me to knock it down. Therefore, the buyer may wish to just say, look, I'll add a condition advising that it's subject to satisfactory building approval searches or council searches prior to a relevant date.
Right.
And if so, the seller may agree to that.
Okay, so it's kind of narrowing it down to maybe a one or more specific investigations that you want to do.
That's exactly it, and it doesn't have to be building approval. It could be, say, a research of the body, corporate records, blood report, soil test report, anything like that, basically.
Okay, no, that's good. Now, any other special conditions, Robert, that you want to share with us today?
Well, another one I would suggest, alternatively, the buyer sees a great opportunity, however, just simply won't be able to afford it without the sale of a prior property.
Right.
That sort of a clause would give the buyer the ability to know that if, for example, their prior sale doesn't go through, something happens, they're not able to find a buyer, or their buyer terminates for whatever reason, they're not stuck in an unconditional contract in which they simply can't afford because their prior sale didn't sell.
And in that scenario, I mean, they're kind of opening themselves up, if they can't settle, then to the seller potentially suing them, aren't they, for damages?
Absolutely. And those damages can get quite scary quite quickly. The standing clause contains, or standing contracts contain provisions such as if the seller resells and sells at a loss, they can sue the buyer for those damages, plus, say, unpaid rates, water levies, things such as legal fees, agent fees, default interest. It can get quite heavy quite quickly.
Adds up quickly. Now, with a clause such as this, there'd have to be some time limits on it, wouldn't there, as far as selling their prior property? Because the seller of the property is not going to just let them say, well, whenever I sell it, you know, it could be 12 months down the track. How does that work?
Absolutely. And sellers just, you're right, sellers just won't agree to that. There will have to be a date in which there has to be the prior sale of the property go through. Some sellers may agree that that be prior to at least settlement, as long as the settlement date isn't, again, 12 months down the line.
Sure.
Other ones, you'd see if the buyer's already got a contract on the sale of their property but just needs to make sure that that goes through prior to their purchase, it may be, say, 14 days or 28 days, whatever the relevant period is.
Yep.
Or some buyers might say, look, I've just started to try to sell my property now. It might take 3 months. You put about 3 months down the line then.
What's the kind of typical timeframes that a seller would be willing to accept? Would it be kind of up to 3 months? You wouldn't imagine me too much more than that, would you?
It generally wouldn't be too much more than 3 months. And personally, I don't see much come through over 3 months.
Right.
Unless there's special circumstances.
Sure.
And especially if, say, the seller is currently living in the property, they want to get their circumstances put in place as soon as possible.
Sure, so they know where they stand.
Exactly. They've got to book removalists. They've got to change electricity and gas bills over. It's a major inconvenience if they're sitting there for 12 months just in limbo.
Not knowing where they stand. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one, Robert. Okay, and do you have anything else for us there as far as special conditions are concerned?
Maybe a last one or an alternative option would be, especially for investors, if they're looking to, after settlement, rent the property out to potential tenants.
Yes, yep.
Maybe after the property becomes unconditional, after the sale becomes unconditional, they put in a clause, well, I'll rephrase that, at the signing of the contract, they put in a condition that after it becomes unconditional, the buyer is allowed to show the property to prospective tenants prior to settlement. This would therefore then hasten up or fasten up the process of being able to get tenants in, and therefore then you don't have to potentially waste 2 or 3 weeks showing the property to tenants before you get them in paying rent, whilst notwithstanding you're still paying the mortgage off. Hopefully then the tenants would be able to move in, say, 2 or 3 days after settlement, and you can get them paying your mortgage off as soon as possible.
That's a great one. So potentially you might have 14 days from unconditional to settlement, so it gives you a couple of weeks to get your property on the market, find your tenants, get them lined up. So as you say, you're just minimising that time between settlement and when you can actually generate some income.
Absolutely. Just a thing to be aware of is that some sellers, they may still be living in the property or they may have tenants of their own in the property that are leaving prior to settlement. So you've got to minimise the disruption to them. So some clauses put in place arrangements that you can only, say, have 3 viewings during the unconditional period, or that you've got to give reasonable notice of, say, 48 hours
right. To
any prospective showing. As long as you're generally reasonable, sellers will accommodate you. But if you're being over the top, sellers obviously get annoyed and pestered by it all.
Absolutely. No, that's fair enough. Well, that's fantastic, Robert. Thanks very much for joining us today on Property Wise. It's been a pleasure to have you on. There's some great information there for our listeners on the contract conditions.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Robert. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, we're now going to have the second half of the headline news over to Craig.
New professional body providing real estate agents with a certified practicing label has been established in a bid to drive professionalism and to raise the public perception of real estate agents. Part of the approach of the CPREA, or Certified Practicing Real Estate Agent, is to assist agents from entry level by providing an associate level option to bring them in and help them to continuously improve as they continue their career. And in related news, the Real Estate Institute of Australia has said they are looking to work with state governments to bring in an effective licensing system for Australia's 64,700 real estate agents. The National Occupational Licensing Authority was disbanded in December 2013, something the Real Estate Institute of Australia agreed with, saying the proposed scheme failed to recognise the structure of the industry. The Real Estate Institute of Australia is still looking to encourage a national licensing system, having called for the abolishment of the NOLA. And that's it for Property Wise News.
Thanks very much for joining us again for another episode of Property Wise.
See you next time.
And if you want to jump on the website, please do that, www.propertywise.com. We always welcome your comments, and stay tuned for the next episode.